This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Great to have you with us. Coming up, President Trump will address his first joint session of Congress tonight on Capitol Hill. I'll be there. And so will Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse. He joins me in just a moment to preview the speech and discuss another presidential message that he read on the Senate floor yesterday. We'll talk about that in just a moment. And while more polling may not be needed for state leaders like Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, the polls show that a clear majority of Americans support linking the use of public showers and restrooms to a person's, get this, biological sex. I know that's crazy, but that's where Americans are. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is here on that story. Also, last week, liberal organizers targeted the town hall meetings of Republican lawmakers. Back in my home state of Louisiana, a longtime pastor friend of mine was asked to open one of the sessions in prayer. And what happened, quite frankly, is astonishing. Pastor Michael Sprague joins us a little later here on Washington Watch. And rounding out our program tonight, we've got a lot to cover. George Barna is here to discuss the biggest national worldview survey ever conducted. What did it reveal about the worldview of Christians in America? Well, you're going to have to hold on because George is going to tell us a little bit later here on Washington Watch. And by the way, if you happen to miss anything on your way home, you got to stop and get milk, bread, whatever, you can always check out the archive later tonight at TonyPerkins.com. All of it is saved right there for you, TonyPerkins.com. And if you sign up for our alerts, you'll know what's happening here in our nation's capital. Again, the website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T. Perkins. Hey, I want to thank Sandy Rios for filling in for me. Yesterday, I was in Florida this weekend for the Council for National Policy meeting, which I serve as president of. So I was presiding over that, making my way back yesterday. So I thank Sandy for filling in for me. All right, President Trump will make his first speech, as I mentioned before, joint session of Congress tonight. What will be the big themes of tonight's message? Well, we'll talk about it. With us now is Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska. Senator, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate the invite. Good to be with you. Sounds like a heck of a program. I think we should skip me and go right to the other guest.
Oh, no. You got some good stuff to say. And before we jump into your thoughts on what President Trump will say tonight, in fact, you and I spoke outside the White House a couple of weeks ago. As we were waiting to go into the event where the president unveiled his selection for the Supreme Court, we were talking about a speech that you were preparing to give on the Senate floor, which you gave yesterday. It's a speech that I make reference to quite frequently. It was never given as a speech. It was written, but it was a farewell address by our first president, and it is a document that is studied by government students, by students of history, because it contains a lot of wisdom, and the Senate has recognized that. And since the late 1800s, it has been read on the Senate floor every year on the president's birthday, and you had the distinct honor of doing it yesterday.
Yeah, it was well summarized. It was a special day for me. I get to be the 125th reader of Washington's farewell address. And as you said, it's important for American civics, and we should be teaching it in the schools again. For the first 100 years of this republic, it was actually the most taught civic document, even more than the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, because Washington, as you know, when he was General Washington, resigned his commission at the end of the war, at the end of the Revolution, rather than becoming king, as many thought he would do, including King George III of England. And then he resigned his presidency after the second term. He actually drafted the first version of Washington's farewell address at the end of his first term, not wanting to serve even a second term, but just to espouse and explain Republican, small r, Republican virtues to the citizens about why we have limited government and why the center of life is not in political office, but it's in places like Mount Vernon and the towns where all your listeners are from, where they're raising their kids and worshiping in the pews and feeding their neighbors. So it's a really special speech, and it was a lot of fun to read.
Well, I know with your background in academics and, you know, understanding the importance of giving young people a solid foundation, I cannot think of a document that is more instrumental in giving Americans an understanding of how our system should work than this message from a practitioner, one who not only had the theory, but he actually had served at the point that this message was delivered. It was drafted after the first, but it was modified pretty significantly after his second term. And this basically was a message to a young republic of, all right, here's what you need to do if you want to be successful.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it obviously wasn't explicitly a call for term limits, but it functioned that way. It was a call against, a warning against partisanship, a warning against excessive faction, because we wanted the center of life to be all the private little platoons and communities where we raise our kids and where we live. And then you should have a public mindedness about those limited number of things we do together. And then obviously, he emphasized strongly the belief that Americans need to be religious and virtuous in order to maintain our freedoms, because he thought that only private virtue and actual commitments and reasons that taking your oath seriously would bind the conscience could possibly hold people back from the excesses of fallen human sinfulness. And so all our efforts are in vain, according to Washington, as a public community, if we don't first recognize the importance of being a virtuous people.
And he was very clear about that, Senator Sasse, in the message about talking about those fundamental pillars of our society, of our republic, morality and religion, and cautioned that we could not have that morality without religion. Therefore, it was very clear that the founders were not hostile toward religion. In fact, they knew that it was essential to our success. I want to ask you this, Senator Sasse, when you just read the speech again yesterday from the floor of the Senate. Would you characterize the ideals that he put forth in that farewell address to the nation as something that some would find controversial today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you just think about things as particular as the policy view he had about debt. I mean, there's a lot that's controversial in it. He thought that a nation that had excessive deficit spending would run up big national debts and be unable to avoid all the sort of generational transfer of imprudence, of saying to the next generation, you don't need to live within your means. You could just do all these crazy things and promise more than you could possibly deliver and hope somebody else solves the problems for you. How can you have a Republican, again, small-R Republican citizenry that will be self-constrained and self-restrained if we don't live that in our public life? He obviously talked a lot about a trade in the document, about how he didn't want permanent foreign political alliances where we would get ourselves drawn into pro-French or anti-French positions in Europe, but we should be some of the best people at production and farming and commerce in the world, and then find particular agreements that were in the interests of the American people. So there's a lot in it that feels both timeless and, you know, regularly controversial, but I wouldn't want to be on the other side of a debate with General President Citizen Washington.
You're absolutely right. Well, let me ask you this before we move on to what we're anticipating tonight from President Trump. As a senator sitting in, you know, one of the most you know, prestigious bodies in the world, not just here in this country, but in the world, what do you take, practically speaking, from President Washington's farewell address to the nation? What is there in that for us today that we could learn from?
Well, you know, one of the things that I don't think we do well in our public life, and some of it's, you know, the nature of a 24/7 television and digital media culture where people are trying to substitute for all of the things that are actually fulfilling in our lives and in our communities and our relationships and our neighborliness. There is a desire many people have, and Washington sort of attuned to nearly Christian anthropology about the fallenness of human souls and the desire we have to find a way to be tribal so we can put ourselves always on the side of righteousness and be against the other, as opposed to figuring out what we might share in common in a public project like the public space. He warns against this faction because he says that we have this desire to constantly be screaming at another as opposed to figuring out the limited purposes we should have in common. And when you think about how often politics become entertainment and tribe to people today, we don't do enough to celebrate gratitude, and we don't do enough to think about all the blessings that we've inherited. And he lingers for a long time in the text of the farewell address on how glorious it is that we have a written constitution that has an explicit process for amendment. said, I don't think that the rules of government, even the fundamental law of the Constitution, is so timeless that we would never want to change it. But we live, I mean, he wasn't quoting Romans 13 here, but we live under a world where there is an established order, and we know that our souls can so often be lawless. It's great that we can change our government, but what a blessing it is that we have an explicit constitutional amendment process, and he calls us to pay attention to the text of the document of the Constitution and submit to it, unless we can persuade people to change it through an orderly process. And we're just obviously not teaching our kids that. They don't know much about the Constitution, and it's a glorious document, and Washington's text is a big tribute to it.
Yeah, without question. And folks, I would encourage you to, you don't have a copy, you can just Google it, Washington's Farewell Address. It is well worth the read, doesn't take you very long, and it's insightful. In fact, it's something that every student in America should read. It absolutely should.
And Tony, let's also urge the fathers and mothers in your audience to read it to their kids, because it's a bit of a document. I mean, it's 45 minutes long to read the whole thing in a kind of literary way. You can read it a little faster than that if you wanted to your kids, but there's a lot there that's fun to parse together as a family.
Yeah, and it will exercise your vocabulary, because it harkens back to the kind of the old English. But it's well worth the read and very insightful. And I tell you, it was some of those documents that I read as a student at Liberty University, a business student, I should say, that was required by the late Dr. Jerry Falwell to take a government course. In looking at those documents, realizing how far off track we had gotten is what drew me eventually into to government. So fascinating document, folks. I would encourage you to read it. Senator Ben Sass, my guest, you're listening to Washington Watch. All right, Senator, let's move quickly to the big themes tonight that we should hear from President Trump in his first ever address to a joint session of Congress.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing from the president. It's a big night for him. It's a big night for the country. And, you know, I hope that he pitches our nation on an optimistic path and vision to celebrate the American people, the 320 million folks who really do make this country great. I hope to hear him championing the producers, the farmers, and the ranchers, and the folks that are living a life of gratitude to God by serving their neighbor in different, you know, shops and storefronts and industrial spaces as well. I definitely hope we hear a serious plan for tackling the generational challenges that are in front of us. We have a decades-long battle against jihadism coming up, and I hope he outlines a lot of that strategy. I was with Secretary Mattis today, our former Marine general, now Secretary of Defense, and I know that he's been meeting with the president for his plan to defeat ISIS, so I hope we hear about the ISIS plan in particular, but the long-term battle against jihadism in general. I obviously hope we hear him talk about the frontiers of cyber war. We have a long, long battle in front of us. When you talk with the generals now, they're very worried about how fast the nature of warfare is going to change. And then you mentioned Neil Gorsuch, the president's nominee to the Supreme Court. You and I were together. The president invited us to the White House when he rolled that out. I obviously hope we hear that. And then let's repeal and replace Obamacare. There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, there is absolutely a lot to talk about. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot of it tonight as the president addresses this joint session of Congress. Senator Ben Sass, thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to seeing you tonight.
Thanks, Tony. Take care.
All right. Nebraska Senator Ben Sass. And obviously we'll dissect the speech tomorrow, but it begins at 9 p.m. Eastern time, 8 Central. Anyway, don't go away, because when we come back, we got a lot more to cover. We're going to be talking with the Lieutenant Governor of Texas right here. Don't go away. We're right back after this.
Whoa, we have not had a response like this before. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We've been doing these spiritual heritage tours for like 20 years. We're sold out for June already, if you can believe that. We've got space left on our September tours of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon, and then Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. We call them spiritual heritage tours, and I don't know how long these September seats will last. To what do you attribute that to, someone might ask? Maybe it's the fact that we have a new person occupying the White House. Maybe that has something to do with it. But in any event, we welcome you to come with us on our September Spiritual Heritage Tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon and Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. Those are two separate trips. You can do both or you can do one or the other. We'd love to have you. Go to spiritualheritagetours.com. spiritualheritagetours.com.
These days, health insurance is incredibly expensive, especially if you don't have coverage through your employer. If you're concerned about the costs or the ethical dilemmas of insurance, here's great news. There's an affordable, God-honoring alternative. It's called MediShare. Unlike insurance, MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing community whose members share each other's medical expenses. It's about half the cost of insurance, and it's fully acceptable under the law. Best of all, you never pay for things that go against your beliefs. If you're a Christian looking for a truly affordable healthcare solution, MediShare is just what the doctor ordered.
Learn how thousands of Christians can help you save on your healthcare. For your free information guide, call 855-PSALM-23. Not available in Montana. MediShare, affordable biblical healthcare. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. The First Lady of the United States praying a Christian prayer in public? Seriously? Sadly, your local township supervisor might be hesitant to pray at the local town hall. Yet here was Melania Trump praying the Lord's Prayer before a watching world. What have we come to as a people that we have such skepticism? For I know many of you had such feelings as myself. Who rules the United States anyway? Satan or God? We want God to bless America, and yet we don't know how to respond when the First Lady prays the Lord's Prayer. We want to cry out to God, "Hallelujah, Jesus yet lives in America." Please, Lord, bring revival and restoration to our embattled America. Help us to be discerning and keep us from skepticism when it's unwarranted. Renew a right spirit within us. This is a Decency Minute. Find us at AmericanDecency.org. I'm Bill Johnson.
To Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. By the way, there's information there. If you'd like to consider going with us on a cruise this summer to Alaska, the Free to Believe cruise, you can find out more. It's going to be a great, great event. General Boykin will be there, myself, Ken Blackwell, and some other great guests. Anyway, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. You can find out more about that. That's a cruise, an Alaskan cruise coming up this summer. All right, another poll out this week affirming the Trump administration's move to rescind the Obama-era guidance letter, forcing schools to open their showers, locker rooms, and bathrooms to either sex. A Marist poll shows a majority of Americans, 66% to 27%, do not think someone who is transitioning to become the opposite sex should be allowed to use whichever shower or locker room they want. Now, this on the heels of a Rasmussen poll last week revealing the same opposition. I mean, look, it just doesn't, you cannot get Americans, and sometimes they've been able to, but on this issue, you cannot get them to defy common sense. I mean, it only makes sense that people should use the bathroom which they're biologically aligned with, male and male, female and female. Now, this poll by Crux and Marist goes on to say that 8 in 10 Americans say doctors and other healthcare professionals should not be forced to be involved with operations intended to change someone's sex if they disagree with such procedures for religious reasons. Now, that's pretty significant. 80%. Say doctors should not be, a healthcare provider should not be forced to be involved in a sex change operation or anything related to that transitioning process if they have a religious concern. Now, this ties back into this whole issue with what we've been talking about on religious freedom and the president issuing an executive order that would not force businesses and other individuals to go counter to their deeply held orthodox religious views on this issue. Now, it goes on, this poll goes on, By a margin of 30%, 62% to 32%, Americans believe employers should be legally allowed to opt out of covering medical procedures intended to change a person's sex on the basis of the freedom of religion. Now, this is very similar to the Hobby Lobby case, which went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court recognized the religious freedom rights of privately held businesses like Hobby Lobby. Of course, that case was about the HHS mandating businesses cover, I think it was about 21 different contraceptives, including a few which could act as abortifacients. And that was the three or four particular products that Hobby Lobby just did not want to cover in their health care plan. So it's good to see that a growing number of Americans recognize the importance of religious liberty and this conflict that exists because of this radical social agenda that was pushed by the Obama administration. I see it as even something more dangerous than just pushing a radical social agenda. This is really the deconstruction of society. I mean, if you think about it for a moment, I mean, what they're pushing for, and this was kind of a last gasp of the Obama administration to push these bathroom orders through. And I think we're waiting. I think the lieutenant governor is going to join us from Texas. I was with him this weekend, and I know their polling shows the same information in Texas. Vast majority of Texans are opposed to these forced policies, forcing kids. We're talking about kids, school, elementary, through junior high and high school, into college. Not only locker rooms and showers and bathrooms, but dormitory rooms and any field trips. This is crazy stuff. But this is a part of the deconstruction of society. I mean, if you think about it for a moment, if you can, you know, deconstruct the very concept that there is, you know, I mean, if you can deny the biological realities of male and female, I mean, really, what's left? If you can literally say that, you know, I'm not a male, I feel like a female, or, I mean, what keeps you from, you know, I mean, there actually is a movement, especially in Europe, where people, you know, they think they're animals, like dogs, and they dress up like dogs and cats. I mean, serious, you look it up. But maybe look, is that really that far-fetched when you can deny the very biological reality that you're a male or a female? Really, there is no limit to what can be done if we deny these realities. And I'm encouraged, folks. I will have to tell you, I'm encouraged by what I see, what I've seen happening as people are saying, you know what, enough is enough. We're not going to go along with this social charade, this craziness, and we're going to push back. And we saw it in North Carolina. I was with the former governor of North Carolina this weekend, Governor McCrory. I appreciated his courage. Dan Forrest, lieutenant governor, who still in office, led that effort there. North Carolina is doing great. You know, you hearing all these stories about the economic fallout, it's just not true. The economic impact is not there. They're doing well. In fact, their hotel occupancy rates are higher than average. I think we talked about that last week. They're up like 5%, 5.1% over last year. They're doing well. Americans, they understand this. But here's the key. We got to keep speaking up. We cannot be silent when we see this crazy stuff taking place, whether it's in our children's elementary school, the high school, or in the workplace. Folks, find your voice. Have the courage to speak up. All right, still more to come. When we return, a pastor in Louisiana simply praying at a town hall meeting. The response, astonishing. Dr. Michael Sprague joins us here on Washington Watch when we return. Don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch right after this.
Making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Well, first of all, we got a couple good things happening in the economy. It's so important. How about consumer confidence? So if I said consumer confidence was up, that would be putting it very mildly. Consumer confidence. Listen to this. This is, and by the way, this isn't Michigan sentiment. This is the government's take on consumer confidence. Consumer confidence numbers up to a 15-year high. 15-year high. Consumer confidence. What's everybody thinking? I'll tell you what everybody is thinking. Just a year ago, a poll, if America's economy is on the right track, Wall Street Journal poll, it was about 18% said, yes, we're on the right track. Yesterday, 60% said, yes, we're on the right track. Folks, the American people understand a couple of things outside of the world of politics. They understand what they see and feel that is going on. And what they see and feel is an attitude about America, an attitude about business, an attitude about taxes, an attitude that it's not about political agendas that are going to do anything, nor have they ever done anything to drive an economy and to establish prosperity for future generations. You are witnessing firsthand an America that is well on its way already of leaving the next generation a country far better than the way we found it.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along. Lieutenant Governor was running. He's got tied up. He's going to be joining us a little bit later in the program. So we're still going to have Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick of Texas going to be joining us in just a bit. But first, I want to turn my attention back to my home state of Louisiana. You know, last week, a lot of lawmakers, a lot of Republicans had town hall meetings as they were back for the President's Day break. It took place last week. And we know that there were a number of funded protesters that went into various town hall meetings. Well, Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana was having a town hall meeting. And a longtime friend of mine who pastors in Louisiana, Pastor Michael Sprague, was simply – and he also serves as the chaplain in the legislature. It was opening in prayer. And I want you to hear a clip here before I bring him in. I want you to hear a clip. And it's going to be hard to hear all of this because it sounds like chaos. And, in fact, I don't think I could describe it any better. Here, listen to this clip from this town hall meeting last week in Louisiana. Now, folks, that goes on for a while. I will spare you the agony of listening to it, but you can hear some of it. You know, a guy in the background yelling separation of church and state, a girl yelling separation of church and state, when my next guest started to open the meeting in prayer. Joining me now is Pastor Michael Sprague of Louisiana. Michael, welcome to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you, Tony.
Well, it's good to hear your voice, brother. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing fantastic.
Well, you have a way of stirring up crowds when you pray there. Describe to our listeners what took place last week.
Well, Tony, in the state of Louisiana, and I think many states, the tradition is when you have public meetings, community meetings, you start out with an invocation, a prayer, a blessing upon the meeting, and then the Pledge of Allegiance, and then you have whatever the meeting is. And I was the one kicking off the town meeting with just a prayer of looking to God for his help and wisdom for the meeting. When I started, you know, it was just chaos. Shouted down, I've never heard so many words, you know, Lucifer and Nazis and Hitler and shouting. And then when I, my conviction is to just wrap up a prayer in the name of Jesus, amen. And when I said that name, Jesus, it was like the roof was going to blow off.
Now, let me ask you, before you began the prayer, was it already kind of a rowdy crowd, or was it at that point that we saw what we heard started in earnest?
Well, it seems like there was 700-800 people that showed up. There was 200 seats in the room, and I could tell about a half hour early when the 200 came into the room, there was a lot of energy and a lot of rage. I'm not saying that there weren't a few there that had legitimate, you know, dialogue, but a lot of them came with a purpose behind why they were there.
So how did the meeting go after after they blew up at the prayer? How did things go from there?
Well, the Pledge of Allegiance was led by a veteran. He served in Vietnam, 4 tours, and it was the same shouting and yelling throughout the whole prayer. Many didn't stand up. Many people turned their backs on the pledge. And then during Senator Cassidy's time of dialogue and answering questions, I don't know if he ever had 7 seconds where 7 seconds of talk time where there wasn't just shouting and just noise, as much noise as he could make.
Now, Dr. Sprague, were there other normal citizens who were there for the purpose of the town hall, not those protesters who came in simply to disrupt? Did they try to keep the others contained so that they could conduct the business of the town hall?
Well, just my general impression is, you know, maybe there was a handful of people that were there for, you know, the traditional town hall purposes of, you know, dialogue and listening and conversation. Most of the people in the room, I think, came to make a statement and probably make some news.
Now, you have served as the chaplain of the legislature there, and that since my departure there, you've been involved up there at the state capitol in Baton Rouge. Does this in any way dissuade you from being involved as a pastor?
Oh, Tony, I serve with a group called the Capitol Commission that puts a chaplain into tries to every state capital in the country. And so, you know, my calling in a nonpartisan, nonpolitical way is to come alongside of elected leaders, be a good listener, pray with them, and where they want to take a next step in their faith to do that. And I tell you, God is at work. Many people throw stones at elected leaders, but they're human beings too. And the closer they get to the Lord and the more healthier they are, the better they'll serve.
And the better we all will be as a result. Michael, great to have you on the program. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Tony.
All right. Dr. Michael Sprague from Louisiana. Find out more, go to the website, tonyperkins.com. All right. When we come back, the largest survey of its kind, surveying the worldview of Americans. We're going to look at it. George Barna did the research. We're going to talk about that when we come back. And still to come, we're going to have the Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, join us. So a lot more Washington Watch still to come. I know we're in the second half. There's a lot happening, though. Don't go away. We're back with more Washington Watch right after these messages.
One of the great freedoms that most Americans enjoy is the ability to get involved in political campaigns. But what about pastors? Unfortunately, due to a little-known amendment that was passed in 1954 at President Lyndon Johnson's urging, churches and other nonprofit organizations are prohibited from making statements for or against a candidate for public office if they want to remain tax-exempt. This is just one of the many problems with the Johnson Amendment. Not only does fear of IRS action put a chill on the free speech of pastors, it restrains other nonprofit organizations from participating in the debate of public policy in their area of expertise. In addition, the IRS only rarely enforces the Johnson Amendment, causing widespread confusion about what constitutes lawful political speech and what doesn't. For more information on how to amend the Johnson Amendment, visit frc.org/Johnson Amendment. That's frc.org/Johnson Amendment.
News travels fast and it's constantly changing. Keep up on onenewsnow.com. It's a news site featuring the latest breaking stories from across the U.S. and around the world. OneNewsNow.com has well-researched articles from a conservative evangelical perspective with hot topics of concern to Christians right now. Get the full story when you visit OneNewsNow.com.
Consider serving with Friendships. It's an all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished here at home and around the world. We're now taking applications. If you're available to serve without pay, you can be part of the crew reaching out to help people in need. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Oops, there's a piece I missed a little bit.
Grandpa, why do we always pick up litter when we go hiking?
Well, we're just making it nicer for people who come after us a little bit. It's called stewardship.
My grandfather taught me that you should always leave a place better than you found it. That it's important to invest in the lives of your children and grandchildren, leaving them with a godly legacy they can build on. That's why I decided to set up a charitable gift annuity with the AFA Foundation.
It's called stewardship.
I know that my gift will support a ministry that honors the biblical principles I hold dear, and it's a way to invest in the future of our country. The AFA Foundation also arranged for me to have a steady fixed income, so I don't have to worry in the midst of changing times.
Call the AFA Foundation today to find out how you can set up a charitable gift annuity. Just call 800-326-4543, extension 345.
I'm Tony Perkins. You're listening to Washington Watch. Glad to have you along. The website, TonyPerkins.com. You can find out more right there at the website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, keep up with me at T. Perkins. All right, yesterday, the American Culture and Faith Institute released the biggest national worldview survey ever conducted. This looking at the worldview and talking about how you view the world around you through the lenses. What lenses do you look at these things through? As Christians, I think this is extremely important because it has a lot to do with our behavior. Yes. Here to talk about it is the executive director of the American Culture and Faith Institute. He's internationally known for his research work, George Barnett. George, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, thank you. It's good to hear your voice again.
Well, congratulations on this massive study. I know you've been working on this for a while. Tell our listeners what you did, what you revealed yesterday, and why.
Well, essentially what we were trying to do is to understand now that we have this moment in our nation where perhaps we can begin to move the culture back to something that would be more God-honoring, what do we have to work with? What are some of the obstacles going to be? And so we thought, well, the best place to start is by trying to understand what people believe is right or wrong, what's good, what's important, and so forth, because that's what your worldview is. It kind of defines who you are and how you intend to behave. And so we put together the largest worldview study that's been done yet, to my knowledge. We looked at 20 different beliefs and 20 different behaviors and put them together into something we call an integrated disciple score. The idea being that if you want to be a disciple of Christ, someone who wants to be Christ-like, to imitate his life, well, you've got to integrate both biblical beliefs and biblical behavior to be like him. And so we measured those 20 beliefs and 20 behaviors and came up with a series of scores across different segments of the population. And the bottom line on this is, as we put it together, we found that 10% of the adult population in America has what might be considered to be a biblical worldview. 10% are what we would call integrated disciples.
Now, is that 10% of the overall population or 10% of the evangelical population?
No, that's 10% of the total population of people who are 18 years of age and older.
So what's that number-wise we look at? I mean, we got roughly 330 million Americans. What is that breakdown from those over 18? What are we looking
well,
at?
Well, actually, we have about 245 million adults who are 18 and older. And so 10% of them would constitute about 24 million people who we would say probably has a biblical worldview.
So about 24 million adult Americans have what is called a biblical worldview. Were you surprised by that number?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've been doing research for over 30 years. So, you know, I've tracked this in the past using different measures, different approaches. I feel like this is the most comprehensive and certainly the deepest approach that we've taken. 10%, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. You can say, well, realistically, that's not much. You would expect in a nation that has a Christian tradition and certainly Christian history, has numerous churches, a lot of people who go to church, you'd expect that number to be a lot higher. But on the other hand, when you look in the pages of the Bible and you try to understand how does God operate, we know that he has transformed cultures in the past, and when he did so, he never waited until he had a majority of people on his side.
Right.
He always used a remnant. And so I would look at that 10% and say, you know what? That must be the remnant that God wants to use to transform this culture.
Well, we've seen cultures and countries elsewhere that have been changed, transformed by a much smaller percentage. Usually, if you can get to a 3%, you can change a culture if you're intentional and active about it. Well, okay, let's talk. 10% of the overall population. What did you look at it from a standpoint of what percentage that would be of the self-described evangelical community?
We don't really rely upon self-description of faith situations much. We did look at individuals who we would call born-again Christians based on the fact that they say they believe that when they die, they'll go to heaven only because they've confessed their sins and accepted Christ as their Savior.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with that particular group, we found that 31% had a biblical worldview. There was another group that we looked at that I found interesting as well, and those are people who read the Bible on a daily basis. Now, obviously, they're a small proportion of the population. But among those people, less than half have a biblical worldview, just 45%. So clearly, it takes more than simply reading the Bible every day. That's a good and important and necessary thing. But it takes even more than that to get to the place where you actually not just have the right beliefs, but also have translated that into a lifestyle that displays what Christ might do in those same situations.
Okay, well, you took that behavior of Bible reading on a daily basis. What then is the greatest contributing factor to one having a biblical worldview?
You know, often what we find is that it has to do with an individual who's in your life who not only has a biblical worldview, but through the relationship, that trust relationship that they've built up with you, they have the ability to speak into your life. They have the ability to challenge you on different things. There's a degree of accountability that's taking place while that individual is not only speaking to you about things, a form of teaching, but also modeling it through their own behavior. They have the ability to show you what it means to take some of these biblical beliefs and translate them into action.
So that would be Sunday school teachers, small group leaders, friends, mentors, it could be pastors, but you're saying that actual walking this out, taking someone, you know, kind of as the Old Testament says, talking about these things as you sit down, talk about them as you walk in the way, but explaining these things and how it actually integrates with the world around us.
Absolutely, and one of the other things that I think is important to bring up is that parents are perhaps the most important facilitators of a worldview, and the reason for that is that people develop their worldview predominantly between the ages of 18 months of age and 13 years old. It's during that period of time that you develop a worldview that's going to be with you for the duration of your life. What we found in the research is that people's worldview doesn't change very much once they reach their teens or later years. It's during those early years it's developed, and it goes on with you. Now, you may refine it a little bit, but by and large, it's almost set in stone by age of 13. The difference, of course, is if the Holy Spirit decides to intervene in your life and do some kind of supernatural, miraculous change in terms of your perspective, of course, that can happen. But on average, the worldview that you have by the age of 13 is the worldview that you're going to die with.
Folks, parents especially, I hope you heard that. Parents play a critical role. Social science actually shows that as well on other issues. I guess you could relate it to biblical issues in terms of morality. But parents, do not sell yourself short in terms of the influence that you have with your children. All right, George, before we run out of time, I love this stuff. I could talk to you all day long because I think there's so much to be gained by understanding what people are thinking and how they're thinking. What's the purpose? This is a long-term project that you're embarking on because you actually want to move the needle as it pertains to biblical worldview.
Absolutely. We're treating this as a benchmark. This is kind of the study that we'll come back to year after year and compare what we found in February of 2017. We'll do this study every February in the future. And so a year from now, 2 years, 5, 7 years from now, we'll go back and say, all right, how does it compare this year to what it was back in 2017? Are things getting better? Are things getting worse? The idea here was to provide leaders in particular with an understanding of here's where we're starting, now we know where we need to go, and let's start testing different approaches and seeing what works and what doesn't work.
Well, I can tell you, we're going to do our part here on Washington Watch to help that biblical worldview expand within the conservative Christian world all across this country. George Barna, thanks so much for joining us. Fascinating stuff. I want to get with you and talk more about this in the coming weeks.
Let's do it. Thanks so much, Tim.
All right, George Barna. To find out more, go to TonyPerkins.com. Look, more than 6,000 people were interviewed in this. Some of you may have been interviewed. I don't know. But it's very telling and very important because if you want to change a society, you have to have a commitment to what you believe, and a willingness not just to believe it, but act upon it. And that's what's critical. Anyway, go to TonyPerkins.com. You can find out more. All right. We were talking earlier about new polling, more polling, I should say, not new polling, more polling last week, Rasmussen, this week, a Crux Marist poll, making very clear that a majority of Americans believe that people should use the public facilities that correspond to their biological sex, 66% to 27% in this Marist poll coming out yesterday. It's overwhelming. But that doesn't surprise my next guest, the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Texas, Dan Patrick. Dan, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, great to be with you again.
I know this polling doesn't surprise you because it's the same thing that you're seeing in the state of Texas. Not that that makes any difference because right is right, wrong is wrong, but it clearly does show that the vast majority of Americans have not yet been completely duped by the left when it comes to this issue of gender.
Yeah, you're right, Tony. What's amazing in Texas particularly, where we have Senate Bill 6, which we will have a hearing on next Tuesday, and hope to have to the floor the following week, that would stop men from going into ladies' rooms and stop schools from issuing policies where boys and girls shower together, use the same locker rooms, bathrooms, and stop government from doing the same thing in government bathrooms, allowing men in, is that for the last 3 months, we have been bombarded by the liberal print media primarily, but unfortunately, the electronic media picks up on what they read because they don't always do much research. They just pick up on media that's been written, and we've just been bombarded of why this is a bad idea, how it's going to impact the economy. You know, the negative to positive stories have probably been 9-1, but yet our polling started in September, and we just got data back last week, and then other independent polls like University of Texas, Texas Tribune poll, all show that not only is the polling holding, but actually it's improving We're up 16 points with women over 55, for example. Because, Tony, what I found is a lot of people on this issue who don't want men in ladies' rooms and teenagers showering together of opposite sex, is they just assume, of course, this is going to pass. Why is this an issue? This is ridiculous. And so a lot of people are now actually engaging for the first time on our side who understand they're going to have to get in the fight.
And there are some politicians, though, that are still a bit timid about this because of the noise that's being made by the other side. And so this is where the citizens who care about the safety and security of their children and their wives and their sisters and daughters need to weigh in and speak out about this.
Yes, we had the chair of appropriations in the House, and he was in an interview last week. His name is John Zerwas, on an internet interview, and he said he opposes Senate Bill 6, which is our bill. And he has been bombarded by people from his district that, what do you mean? Our House member would oppose this bill? That means he supports boys and girls showering together in high school. That means he supports men in ladies' rooms. He's now had to come back in a Facebook post I read today where he says, I've never been for that, but now that Trump has rescinded the Obama order, we don't need it. Well, that's not true because any school district can go out. This is, you know, what the Trump team said is it's a state's rights issue.
Right.
So, and last week, Mr. Zerwas's complaint was that it was going to impact the economy. So what happens is, Republicans in particular, but even Democrats are going to get heat from their voters because in our polling, and I haven't seen the Marist breakdown, but and you said 66-27, I believe, but in our polling, 80% of Republicans don't want this, and nearly 70% of Hispanic voters and African-American voters don't want this, and over 50% of all Democrat voters don't want it. So, you know, we have some people in elective office who don't seem to get the message. People don't want men in ladies' rooms for many reasons, and it's not about discrimination against anyone. It's about public safety, common sense, common courtesy. And I'll tell you something, and they don't want their teenagers showering together. Let me tell you something else, Tony, that happened here in Texas. You may or may not be aware about it because it happened Thursday when I was with you at an event. But we had a young lady here in Texas who is transitioning, and so she's taking testosterone treatment by the doctor. Her parents approved. And so this young lady just won the state women's wrestling championship. But she won it according to all the opponents because she is so much stronger than all of them. And that has now made a lot more people wake up and say, wait a minute, this young lady, and she has a right to do this. We're not questioning her right to transition if that's what her parents allow,
right.
That's what she wants. But she's taking testosterone. And it has helped her to become stronger. And one of the other impacts of this whole push by the extremist radical left, who pushed this upon us, the majority of the people, without ever asking the majority their opinion, and now are outraged because we're fighting against it. I mean, this all happened literally overnight in the last year, and I've been involved in it from ground zero here in Texas with Obama.
Hey, Governor, we're going to have
next step.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're up against the end of the show. I can't go on even if I wanted to.
Hey, I got you, but we're going to have boys taking scholarships and spots from girls playing sports in schools. That's the next
All right. Governor, I'll see you in Texas next week.
Thanks, Tony.
Folks, I'll see you tomorrow, Lord willing. Don't forget, as the Apostle Paul says, when you keep standing, well, just keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.